This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
It's called protein degradation. And if you're a bad protein in a cancer cell, you'd better get your affairs in order. Because now, thanks to Dana-Farber's foundational work, protein degradation can target cancer-causing proteins and destroy them right inside the cell. This take-no-prisoners approach is making a difference in multiple myeloma and other blood cancers, and is how Dana-Farber is working to treat previously untreatable cancers. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today, produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Today's one of those days when the way policy gets made in this country just makes you shake your head. The topic at hand is healthcare and the much-debated public option. Forget just one plan. How about, 50 of them? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Palm Wonderful, 100% pomegranate juice in the curvy bottle, the antioxidant superpower. Information at pomwonderful.com. And by Gather.com, the social network where people can make new friends who share their interests. People talking about today's news at news.gather.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It's great to have you with us on this Wednesday. It is the 7th of October today. And if you had to pick one part of the healthcare debate that has gotten the most attention, aside from maybe death panels, the public option would be a pretty safe bet. The lines are fairly clearly drawn. Democrats on the left generally believe a government-run health insurance option is the only way to create competition and so force insurance companies to cut their prices. Republicans and some moderate Democrats think a public plan would just drive those private insurers out of business. The search for common ground continues, though, hence the latest idea. Forget the federal government. What about state-run public health plans? From Washington, Tamara Keith helps us imagine how they might work.
So you don't like the idea of a national public plan. What about 50 smaller public plans run by the states? Senator Tom Carper, a Democrat from Delaware, is shopping that idea. Those aren't his words exactly. Here's how he put it in a video on his website.
Say to states, if you don't have much competition, you don't have very good affordability, you can elect to establish your own option, your own state option.
What would it look like? Say you're shopping for health insurance in Maryland. You'd probably go on a website listing all the plans offered in your state. There would be plans from the private insurers we all know, and
one option would be so-called Maryland health plan or the state-based public option.
Meg Murray is the CEO of the Association of Community-Affiliated Plans. She says states have experience with this because they manage Medicaid, the health program for the poor, and she likes the idea.
We believe that all health care is local, and so that the public plan should be established and organized and run on a local basis.
Washington State already has a public plan of sorts. Washington Basic Health covers 83,000 of the state's working poor. The state contracts with private insurers. Members choose a plan and pay a small premium. The state pays the rest. Dave Wasser is with the Washington State Healthcare Authority.
They pay us their monthly premium, but otherwise it's more like they are a member of that health plan that they selected.
Wasser says it's a popular program, but it's still far from clear whether this idea will make it into the healthcare legislation. In Washington, I'm Tamara Keith for Marketplace.
On the topic of healthcare legislation, you can score a win for Senate Finance Committee Chairman Max Baucus today. Late this afternoon, the Congressional Budget Office released the authoritative version of what Baucus's bill is going to cost. The CBO tallies it up at $829 billion over the next decade. Or maybe this is easier, almost $83 billion a year. We will be graced with the September numbers on retail sales tomorrow. There will be lots and lots of talk about what those figures might mean for the looming Christmas shopping season. We figured we'd avoid the rush and do the story today about whether it's going to be another horrifying holiday or whether consumers are finally ready to spend again. And if they are, will they be pulling out the plastic? Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
I pulled out the plastic this morning for my daily latte.
2.70, debit or credit?
That's the question a lot of consumers will be asking themselves. A debit card effectively means paying in cash. A credit card means taking out a loan. David Robertson publishes the Nielsen Report on card purchases. He says increasingly consumers are steering away from credit and opting for debit.
Closing down credit card accounts, paying down balances and not using those cards, and paying in real time, if you will, paying now.
Davidson says usually credit card purchases rise in the lead up to the holidays, not this year.
Even people who tend to pay their bill in full every month will splurge at the holiday season, and this year that's simply not going to be the case. Fewer people are going to be borrowing money and paying it back over time.
That means retailers will be selling less, especially high-priced items like electronics and jewelry, because consumers tend to charge them rather than dinging their checking account right away. Michael Fisher has two family-owned appliance stores in Iowa.
We are seeing consumers who are cautious. There's no doubt about that.
That makes him cautious, too, so he's cutting back on the inventory he orders to stock his shelves for the holidays, which could hurt his suppliers. Fisher's gotten used to the idea this could be a slow holiday season, but he says Americans are saving more, and that's good news.
And if you talk to any of the regional bankers where I live, none of them are short of money to lend. The money is being saved, and I think long-term it's healthy for all of us.
A silver lining, if not for his stores in the short term, then perhaps for his region and the country. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Burger King made a royal proclamation today. The company said over the next couple of years it's going to be revamping the decor in most of its restaurants. Less beige, more flamey blacks and reds, brick on the walls, and industrial metal on the countertops. Marketplace's Rico Galliano explains why and whether franchisees are having it their way.
Burger King made the announcement at its restaurant in Amsterdam, Schiphol Airport. And Tom Miner of food industry consultants Technomics says the choice of location was symbolic.
They're looking for this new design to position them very aggressively in global markets.
Markets like Europe and Asia, where Burger King hasn't been as aggressive as McDonald's and KFC.
The attributes of this new store, it's going to fit what Europeans and Asians have in mind as to what an American hamburger a restaurant should be like.
And Miner says the new decor also features more restaurant-style seating, an attempt to help Burger King's here in the U.S. compete with dine-in chains like Chipotle. But BK says the redesigns could cost as much as $600,000 a store. Are franchisees going to pony up? Burger King's Brian Geis thinks so.
We actually have a number of franchisees that have adopted the design already, and they've all been very pleased with the results. We typically see double-digit sales lift.
A lift of 12% to 15%, according to Geis. But Morningstar analyst R.J. Hadavi says those figures sound a little high, and he expects owners will be skeptical, too.
Frankly, I think this might be a tough sell for certain franchisees. We're dealing with a tough sales environment, you know, a lot of cost increases.
BK says franchise owners will have options if they can't afford a total overhaul, but the company says owners are contracted to maintain, quote, a modern image. In Los Angeles, I'm Rico Galliano for Marketplace.
Traders on Wall Street couldn't quite make up their minds today. We will have the details when we do the numbers. There are a whole lot of moving parts as the Obama administration keeps on trying to get the economy going. And while some economic indicators are promising, there is a big one out there that is most definitely not. Employment. We're down more than 8 million jobs since this recession started. That helps explain the trial balloon that's being floated in the news today, giving companies tax credits if they create new jobs and hire people to fill them. To help explain how that might work, and if it might, we've called Harvard University economist Greg Mankiw. Good to have you with us.
Nice to be with you.
This idea of tax credits to get companies hiring again obviously is in the press today. What else might work if the government wanted to try to convince companies to do something?
Well, there's been a variety of ideas sort of on the table. A variety of economists, including myself, have been talking about a payroll tax cut as part of the stimulus package. I was proposing that 6 months ago when the original stimulus package was put in place.
Payroll tax cut would be unemployment, Social Security, those kinds of things.
Yeah, every worker pays a payroll tax that's earmarked for Social Security and Medicare, and we could certainly sort of cut that tax and use other sources of revenue for those programs. The idea would be that it would provide incentive for firms to hire because the cost of labor would be lower.
What about just direct aid to states? The federal government gives the states money, and then the states spend it to get companies hiring again.
Well, they've done some of that, and that probably makes some sense. I mean, partly it depends on one's view of the relationship between the federal government and state governments. And just like every household has to deal with its own finances, at some level, each state has to deal with its own finances and can't always turn up to a higher level of government to deal with their problems.
There is something about this discussion of tax credits and the government getting companies to hire that actually stumps me. Aren't we still asking companies, even if we give them tax credits or direct aid, aren't we asking them to hire in an economy where consumer demand is still weak, where businesses are unsure of the demand for their products, and is this going to be any incentive?
Yes, you're absolutely right. You have to think about both supply and demand, and firms certainly in thinking about how much labor to hire and how much they have to produce are thinking about whether they're going to have customers to buy that. And a large part of what the macro policy has been doing has been trying to prop up the agri demand for goods and services. That's certainly been the purpose of the stimulus package. And that's certainly what the monetary authority is trying to do, what the Fed is trying to do by keeping interest rates so low, by buying mortgage-backed securities. They're trying to make loans more readily available in order to get agri demand up so those customers will be coming in the door and firms will have a reason to hire.
So if you run, let's say, a concrete company, and there's nobody buying your concrete to build buildings, is there an amount of money the government could give you that's going to make you hire?
Well, demand curves slope downward. But that means when things are cheaper, people buy more of them. And that includes companies. So when the cost of labor is less, people will hire more workers. And I think one of the ideas of trying to reduce the cost of labor through something like a payroll tax cut is in order to incentivize firms to hire more. But that's also going to put money in the pockets of corporations and money in the pockets of workers, and that will give them resources to spend. So I think that's one of the reasons why economists have been looking at a payroll tax cut as one possible tool to use in terms of getting the economy going again.
Is it an achievable goal? Can we create enough new jobs to get this economy where it needs to be by tax credits and payroll tax cuts?
I think we can help. The big question is, what does the aftermath of a financial crisis look like? The history of other financial crises that economists have studied tend to suggest you don't get a rapid recovery. We have had deep recessions with rapid recoveries. The 82 recession is one example. Most economists don't look at that as a model for this recovery, and so unemployment is going to be high for a while.
On that topic of economic recovery, there is still plus or minus $500 billion in stimulus package money that's not out there yet. What about the theory that says, listen, we should just wait and see what happens with that before we start plowing new money in here?
Well, I think that's probably right. It probably makes sense to just wait and see what effect it is going to have. Let Ben Bernanke continue to do his job of trying to stimulate the economy, get financial markets going again, rather than thinking about a massive new stimulus package at this very moment.
Greg Mankiw, he's a professor of economics at Harvard University. Professor, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you.
There will be no parades to mark the occasion today. Germans prefer to celebrate the day East Germany disappeared, not the day it was created. But this is the 60th anniversary of the founding of the communist German Democratic Republic. The GDR collapsed in 1990, and reunification with the West was a painful experience, politically and economically. Companies in the East were closed and privatized, but some did survive. From Berlin, Brett Neely reports on how they're doing now.
Zeha Shoes was East Germany's only sneaker company, the Adidas of the East. Sports teams across the Eastern Bloc wore Zehas. A few years ago, Zeha fanatic Torsten Heine was able to buy the trademarks of the East German sports empire fallen on hard times.
All the people out there were keen to wear Western brands, and they lost their sports market as well. And so, all of a sudden, they lost everything they had and needed to close down.
Over 14,000 companies in East Germany closed. Many of them had been household names. Some even made stuff worth buying, said retail expert Nils Busch-Petersen. But that made little difference.
The good items from quality East German brands sat on the shelves and didn't sell. People's consumer preferences changed literally overnight.
But those preferences have shifted back again.
Guten Tag.
This store, in the center of what was East Berlin, only sells products made in the former East Germany. But this is no nostalgic trip back to a time when the shelves were empty and the goods were clunky. Store owner Bianca Schaler is proud of the range of goods she offers.
Dann haben wir unseren Kaffee. Here's our coffee, some of the well-known and well-loved brands. This is Rondo Coffee, the classic Rondo Melange, or also the Mocha Fix Gold.
All these East German brands have succeeded in wooing back their customers. Retail expert Busch Peterson says East Germans rediscovered their loyalty to local products when they realized that there was a hidden cost to buying the Western goods.
They'd go and buy a different detergent, and suddenly the detergent factory around the corner would be threatened with closure because no one was buying the old East German stuff anymore.
Some East German brands have even managed to cross the old Iron Curtain and build a following in what was West Germany. For example, Rotkäppchen, Little Red Riding Hood, Germany's most popular sparkling wine. Founded in the 19th century, the winery was nationalized by the communists. After the wall fell, the new owners started to market the cheap bubbly to Westerners. Rotkäppchen now sells $1 billion a year worth of fizz and dominates the German market. A few years ago, it even bought out its biggest rival, a West German firm. Now it's moving upscale, just like Zeha Shoes. Along with a partner, Zeha's owner Torsten Heine has reinvented the brand and opened several stores in trendy Berlin neighborhoods.
So on this side, on the left-hand side, you can see our sneaker collection. This is our premium sneaker collection based on soccer shoes from the 50s and 60s.
Starting price, about $150 a pair. These days, Zeha's target market is well-heeled hipsters rather than proletarians. Heine says business is booming. The company has even opened a new store. It's on West Berlin's most famous shopping street, the Kudamm. And it's not far from the flagship stores of Nike and Adidas, the brands that nearly wiped out the Zeha name just 20 years ago. In Berlin, I'm Brett Neely for Marketplace.
Coming up, trying to save a New York institution.
It's where I do my manufacturing. It's where I make my money. It's how I keep my staff employed. But also it's worth fighting for the future. It's worth fighting for the next generations of fashion designers that are coming up.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials parted with 5 points today, closing down less than a tenth of 1%, ended at 9,725. The NASDAQ advanced 6 points, about 0.3%, closed at 2110. The S&P 500 lifted 2 points, a tad more than 0.25%, finished at 1,057. AT&T trimmed 0.6%. Today, Verizon rang down 1%. The chairman of the Federal Communications Commission said today he's going to draw up rules to keep the internet open to all users. Alcoa fattened up more than 2% ahead of its earnings release. Those numbers came out after the bell, and they were better than expected. The aluminum giant said it made a profit thanks to cost cuts and rising aluminum prices. The price on the 10-year T-note rose. That pushed the yield down to 3.18%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term goals. 1-888-VANGUARD. And by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing and online surveys. ConstantContact.com. Why is a cram down like a slice of cake? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. It's on our website, marketplace.org. There you'll find videos unwrapping the basics of the financial crisis.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events for Thursday. The Labor Department releases its weekly report on initial jobless claims. It's National Depression Screening Day. Individuals can be anonymously screened for depression for free. Go to mentalhealthscreening.org for more. And on this day in 1956, New York Yankees pitcher Don Larsen pitched the only perfect game in World Series history. I'm Millie Jefferson.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Small business owners will be relieved to hear that CIT is still alive, at least as of right now it is. This country's biggest lender to small and medium-sized businesses is smack up against a Chapter 11 filing even after a federal bailout. Commentator Robert Reich says the CIT saga is just the latest example of business as usual on Wall Street and in Washington.
CIT Group, one of the nation's biggest small business lenders, is on the brink. If its bondholders reject CIT's last-ditch plan, which seems increasingly likely, the company will become the fifth largest bankruptcy in U.S. history. And when CIT goes under, it will also take taxpayers with it, to the tune of $2.3 billion, which is what the firm got from the Treasury's Wall Street bailout program last December. But here's an interesting thing. When CIT goes down, Goldman Sachs reportedly will receive $1 billion from CIT under a 2008 rescue agreement between the two firms. Now, why will Goldman get $1 billion while taxpayers lose more than twice that? Because the Treasury failed to protect taxpayers' interests nearly as well as Goldman protected Goldman's interests. And why was that? Incompetence at Treasury? Close ties between Treasury and Goldman Sachs? Just bad luck? You can rule out bad luck because almost the same thing happened last fall after the Treasury bailed out AIG, which owed Goldman $13 billion. AIG still hasn't repaid us taxpayers and probably never will, but when we bailed out AIG, Goldman got repaid its money. Goldman has announced record earnings for the first 6 months of this year and set aside $11.4 billion for a bonus pool for its executives and traders, which comes to a few $1 billion less than we taxpayers have indirectly channeled to Goldman since last fall. I don't want to pick on Goldman. All top five Wall Street banks have profited nicely from the bailout. All have increased their market shares. All their executives and traders are now making bundles, and all continue to have close ties to Washington. Now, some in Congress want to set limits on Wall Street pay. This is one of several measures being considered for financial reform. The Treasury doesn't like the idea, but it sounds reasonable to me. As long as we taxpayers continue to bail out the street, which seems likely to continue for some time, our tax dollars will inevitably find their way to these giant banks and their executives and traders. Just follow the money and watch what happens with CIT.
Robert Reich is a professor of public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. Take a moment to send us your thoughts. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. On the west side of Manhattan in New York City, between about 34th and 40th Streets, is an area known as the Garment District. It's one square mile that's been a center of American fashion, both design and manufacturing, for more than 100 years.
If you walked through my design room and you saw that we're sewing about 20 things at a time, and each one of those things needs threads, buttons, zippers, snaps, hooks and eyes. So as we start to realize, oh no, we need a zipper for that dress and we don't have a pink one, like an intern will run out the door and go to the zipper shop and come back with that. Or on the next block over, there's all the lace stores and the trimming stores.
Designer Nanette Lepore makes most of her clothes right in the Garment District. She showed us around where her dresses get stitched, the buttons put on, and the fabric steamed. Lepore's been in Manhattan for 20-some-odd years. She'd like to stay there, but Mayor Michael Bloomberg wants to change the city zoning laws to open up the unused spaces in the Garment District, shrink the manufacturing that's there, and turn it into restaurants and hotels or other offices. That is not an idea that Nanette Lepore is wild about.
For me, it's personal. It's where I do my manufacturing. It's where I make my money. It's how I keep my staff employed. But also, it's worth fighting for the future. It's worth fighting for the next generations of fashion designers that are coming up. It's for the students that are going to school to learn fashion. Every design student dreams of creating a line of clothing. And you can walk out your door. You can find a factory that will make you 10 pieces of something if that's all you can sell. It can happen.
Manhattan real estate being valuable as it is, Mayor Bloomberg has some plans to consolidate the Garment Center into one or two buildings, make sure that designers and manufacturers have space in that building. You're not buying that.
We can't be shrunken into one or two buildings. It's impossible because he wants to give us about 400,000 square feet in trade for what we're using, approximately 2 million square feet. It would be a figurehead. It would be a building to say, I saved the Garment Center, but he would really be putting us all out of business.
You appreciate, though, that Manhattan real estate is scarce, and so the city has decided maybe it's time to do some other things with it.
I appreciate that, but don't we appreciate a legacy, too? Do we really want our city to go by the way of every other city in this country where it looks the same? New York City is going to suffer if we lose everything that makes it distinct and unique. And fashion brings so much money into this city, and I don't think they understand exactly how it all operates.
Well, how does it work? You sit in your workshop, you come up with a design, you walk around the corner, and there's your manufacturer right there in the middle of Manhattan?
Kind of. I have about 120 of my own employees in addition to the 10 factories that I work with. So between myself and these 120 people, we work through a design to the point where we go into manufacturing on it. And then we take that garment out of my little office and into the bigger world of the Garment Center, where a pattern digitizer will make it into different sizes and spread it into a cuttable form. Then it goes into a cutting room, which is another business in the Garment Center. Then from there, it goes to a factory who then sews one together for us to fit. And then we fit it, and then we give the factory the go-ahead to keep going, and they sew through the 500 to 1,000 units that I would be cutting on a style.
It does seem, though, doesn't it, that you could do it more cheaply somewhere else if you could just send those patterns and designs over to South China and save yourself and your customers a lot of money?
Well, I could make bigger profit for myself, which is, I think, how a lot of people operate in this world. But I feel like I'm happy with my business the way it is. I'm making a quality product. I'm known for my fit and for my quality. And it's because I'm here watching it all the time and I'm able to control what's happening.
What happens then if the mayor goes ahead with his plan, consolidates the Garment Center, and you guys do wind up in two buildings and a couple of 100,000 square feet?
Well, for me, I would get through it. But what happens on the bigger picture is the interest for fashion with buyers and press. They come here to see what's new and exciting. Maybe the focus of fashion would shift to Los Angeles, where the small factories will still exist. Or maybe in 10 years, there'll be a new movement that happens out of Brooklyn. But it will definitely go dormant for a while. We'll lose what we have.
Fashion designer Nanette Lepore, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering total return strategies designed to match your goals. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, what to get for the global traveler who has everything. Just in time for the holiday rush, Amazon is cutting prices on its ebook reader, the Kindle, also coming out with an international version as well. Kindles will now work in 100 countries, including Bolivia, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and Hungary. Not, though, and this is the whole reason I brought this story up, not in Canada. From the Toronto Globe and Mail today, I learned you can't get a Kindle north of the border. Too bad, eh? And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow dropped 5 points, less than a 10%. The NASDAQ rose 6 points, nearly a 3%. The S&P 500 added 2 points, more than a quarter of 1%. Vahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Andrea Jackson-Gewirtz, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the program for us. Coming up next time on the broadcast, changing the way doctors get trained and get paid.
It's not all that I'm about. You know, I'd really like to be able to
work with a refugee population myself, but at this point, it's kind of like unrealistic that I'm going to be able to do that.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.